again, the information is posted by themselves. So we analyze it and we turn, social media posts basically into legal cases. I just want to, since you said we just have a minute, I want to take the opportunity to say that the countries of the world should take their responsibilities. As we speak, Major Ghassan Alian, who is the head of COGAT, which is the entity that oversees the weaponizing of famine in Gaza, is present in Italy to attend a meeting secretly. We have filed a case against them in the International Criminal Court, asking them to activate any arrest warrant that they have against them, or if not, issue a new one. And we also informed the Italian authorities, asking them to activate their responsibility under the Rome Statute, which since they have jurisdiction, and since Major General Alian does not have immunity. This is an example that is now unfolding of how the countries of this world should take their responsibilities. And, I think the Brazilian case was a case where that happened, where a judge actually issued a probe order to investigate a soldier. Unfortunately, the Israeli government smuggled the soldier out of Brazil, which is, of course, obstructing justice. But we are continuing. We are relentless in seeking justice. And we are very convinced that one day justice also will be served in a court of law.
Diab Abu-Jaja, we want to thank you for being with us, co-founder of the Hind Rajab Foundation, the Belgium-based group advocating for Palestinian rights. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Flashpoints. Today on our show, we speak with the plaintiffs in a class action lawsuit filed against two California congressmen for voting to fund the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Then we feature the latest from the Electronic Intifada with Nora Barrows Friedman. Finally, we take a look at the possible banning or forced sale to a U.S. corporation of TikTok, and whether its role as a social media platform for Palestinians to inform the world with real-time streaming of the devastation in Gaza has played a factor. I'm Kevin Pina, and we'll be back with that and more here on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. I want to open up today's program with some breaking news. A press conference that was held by Palestinian journalists today in Gaza, led by Abu Bakr Abed. We know that hundreds of journalists have been murdered and killed in the Israeli ongoing genocide in Gaza. Let's tune in and listen to their words today, direct from Palestine, courtesy of the Electronic Intifada.
These are not my words, but the words of every single one here. Standing here after 459 days of the most well-documented and first live-streamed genocide in history. For these days, we've been reporting tirelessly, extensively, and thoroughly on this genocide. It's indeed a genocide against us, which we've been documenting in makeshift tented camps and workplaces. They are really the places we've taken shelter as shelter since day one. You've seen us shedding tears over our loved ones, colleagues, friends, and family members. You've seen us killed in every possible way. We've been immolated, incinerated, dismembered, and disemboweled and recently we've been freezing to death. What more ways should you be seeing us killed then, so that you can move and act and stop the hell inflicted upon us? There are no words to describe what we've been going through, because you've seen our bodies, how they've become fragile, skinny, and fatigued. But we never stopped. We never stopped to tell you the truth, to narrate our stories, and to tell you that we are being genocided, to move your dead consciences, to help a population that has seen every sort of torture and tasted every type of death. Today, we're all standing here after Israel's impunity against us. And we don't know how many journalists should be killed so you can really act and stop Israel's impunity against us. Our message is very clear. We are journalists and we are Palestinian journalists. We have been let down by the international community, particularly the international media organizations. We haven't seen any sort of support, a single word of support. Even the press vests we're wearing right now, Marcus is a target. They do not protect us at all. But yes, because we are Palestinians, maybe if we were Ukrainians or of any other citizenship with blonde hair and blue eyes, the world would rage and rant for us. But because we are Palestinians, we have only one right, which is to die and be maimed. Finally, we are just documenting a genocide against us. It's enough after almost a year and a half. We want you to stand foot by foot with us, because we are like any other journalists, reporters, and media workers all across the globe, no matter the origin, the color, or the race. Journalism is not a crime. We are not a target.
Again, that was the voice of Palestinian journalist Abu Bakr Abed coming to us today, a press conference. Many journalists were there accompanying him as he spoke today. Let's go ahead and let's take our first break here. We'll be back with more here on Flashpoints. And welcome back to another edition of Flashpoints. I'm Kevin Pina, filling in for Dennis Bernstein, who's on assignment the rest of this week. Well, this next story is about a very innovative approach to trying to stop the U.S. support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. Let's catch up with this short report, courtesy of Straight Arrow News.
Palestinian rights advocates in Northern California are suing two members of Congress over billions of dollars in military aid sent to Israel amid the ongoing Gaza war. A complaint filed Thursday in U.S. District Court alleges Democratic Representatives Mike Thompson and Jared Huffman caused moral injury to a group of over 500 taxpayers in their California districts by voting for a $26 billion Israel aid package in April. The plaintiffs claim the aid violates what they call their constitutional right to have taxes collected for only lawful purposes. The attorney for the plaintiffs says sending military aid to Israel violates multiple U.S. laws, including a ban on supporting genocide.
So just to recoup, a group of citizens, voters, are suing two congressmen in a class action suit against two California congressmen to hold them accountable for casting their vote approving the Israel Security Supplemental Appropriations Act of 2024, which gave Israel another $26.38 billion to continue the onslaught. and the horror that we've seen unfolding in Gaza. Two of the plaintiffs are here with me today. First is Seth Donnelly. He's a high school teacher, Bay Area activist, and a member of the Haiti Action Committee. Also joining us is Maria Barakat. She's a Lebanese-Palestinian anti-war activist, sociologist of law and society and public policy expert, specializing in equity from UC Berkeley. Well, Seth, did I pretty much describe that correctly?
Yes, for funding the genocide in Gaza. Absolutely.
Right. And so this raises a question for me. I know right out the box, it could be a little bit of a challenge, but how many successful lawsuits have there been, have citizens won against Congress for abridging their constitutional rights? This is a great and novel method, but man, I admire you for having that kind of faith in courts and the judicial process in these good United States.
Well, our eyes are wide open, Kevin, and thanks for having us on as always. Our eyes are wide open about the uphill battle in the courts. But we do believe that we have a correct, powerful legal argument, mm-hmm. and that it's one more arena of struggle that should be taken up. In terms of previous cases, there is a case from 1968 called Flass versus Cohen, in which taxpayers established a standing to sue, and that was over their federal tax dollars being used for private religious schooling purposes. And they sued, saying that, you know, this breaches the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, and their suit was upheld by the Supreme Court. Now, they weren't directly suing their congresspeople. They were suing, I think, local government officials that were using the funds. But what that case establishes is that there isn't a carte blanche over how government officials use our federal income tax dollars. So our argument in this case is, just as the government can't use our tax dollars for private religious schools, they ought likewise, on a whole host of other constitutional and federal law, constitutional provisions and federal laws, cannot use our tax dollars to fund genocide.
And you're listening to Flashpoints, and that is the voice of one of our guests today, Seth Donnelly. He's a high school teacher, a Bay Area activist, and a member. Well, I see there's two specific California congressmen. They definitely are, I don't know how to put it here, but they sort of fit the stereotype of a 1950s California congressman. When you look at these guys, Mike Thompson, he represents the 4th Congressional District, and that includes all of Napa and Lake Counties and parts of Solano, Sonoma, and Yolo Counties, and he was first elected in 1998. Mm-hmm. And then the second one is, let's see, Jared Huffman? Right, and he represents the North Coast region. Yeah.
We are tax-paying citizens that pay federal taxes in the North Bay, California. Our class action is made up of about 10 counties that are in these two congressmen's districts. So all the way from Marin County down in the North Bay, Sonoma County up to Humboldt, so all throughout the North Bay. We have almost, I think, 800 to 1,000 class members to this suit at this point, and they're all taxpaying constituents of Mike Thompson and Jared Huffman up here in the North Bay. So we're not suing Congress generally. We're suing our representatives for misusing our tax dollars specifically to fund Israel's genocide.
Maybe this will also get some other folks to do that locally in their state.
Precisely.
Yeah. So it's locally based. You're taxpayers of these two congressmen. And I wanted you to explain something to me, which was that, let me read this. This action is brought pursuant to the United States Constitution. It's authorized by Article 3, Section 2, which extends the federal judicial power to all cases arising in equity under the Constitution. An actual case and controversy exists between the parties where plaintiffs allege the defendant's votes to authorize the funding of the Israeli military was unconstitutional and violated their constitutional rights to have their taxes collected for only lawful purposes. That's kind of the heart of it, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
And then I was wondering about this part that followed. The defendants deny that their votes were unconstitutional. This controversy threatens plaintiffs' constitutional rights and emotional or psychic health. Plaintiffs have no adequate remedy at law to redress the harms herein, which are of a continuing nature. What is this part about somebody saying that your votes were unconstitutional?
So sometimes the public says, well, Congress cannot be, congressmen or congresspersons cannot be sued because they have immunity. But immunity is not absolute. They don't have immunity, for example, like if they're caught taking bribes or for illegal acts. What makes this case particularly powerful and creative in the way that, say, Giuliana versus U.S., the Supreme Court case where the student sued over climate change, is that we're testing boundaries that we believe need to be tested and that are grounded in a correct reading of the Constitution. So they don't have immunity that's absolute, for example, take bribes. And what we're saying is, per Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, that establishes that Congress shall only appropriate and use tax dollars for what they call the quote-unquote general welfare.
And not for unlawful purposes, right?
Correct. And then there's Article 6 of the Constitution establishes that treaties have supreme binding power. Well, because the United States has ratified the Genocide Convention, they did so in 1988, 40 years after the fact that they did, and they did with exemptions, but they did not exempt themselves from the part of the convention that prohibits complicity in genocide. So in other words, complicity in genocide is a crime now assimilated into U.S. federal law. And so they did not have the right even to use our tax dollars, and the vote that we're challenging in question was on last April 20th, which by that point the evidence of genocide was overwhelming, and they'd already been lobbied extensively, grassroots, you know, unpaid lobbying by their constituents through letters, through emails, through phone calls, through meetings, through pickets, saying don't use our tax dollars to do this. It's, you know, there's a genocide happening. And they nonetheless voted on April 20th to send $26.38 billion more to the Israeli military. So our position is that was illegal. That decision to send more military aid violated U.S. Obligations to adhere to the Genocide Convention, as well as a host of federal laws, too, that we name in the complaint, like the Arms Export Control Act and the Leahy Amendment, et cetera.
Right. Very, very novel approach. Again, this is Flashpoints. That's the voice of Seth Donnelly. He's a high school teacher in the Bay Area. He's an activist and a member of the Haiti Action Committee. Also with us is Maria Barakat. She's a Lebanese-Palestinian anti-war activist. Maria, who are the rest of the people who've signed on to this? And is it still open? Are people still going to join this class action suit? And give us a little sense of who the people are who've already signed on.
Yeah, of course. This is an amazing group of folks out here in the North Bay that have come together around this. We've met through our activism and collective work around Gaza this year. We are constituents who... really, we are Palestinian Americans, we are Arab Americans, we are Jewish Americans, we are white and Latino Americans here in the county, and we refuse to be complicit in genocide. I personally, like many of my other Palestinian comrades here in the North Bay, are, for example, in a much more critical and egregious position where our Congress people, Mike Thompson and Jared Huffman, have made us complicit in the genocide of our own people with our own tax dollars. So we are folks who really understand what's happening with the genocide on the ground in Gaza. And we've been screaming all year for our Congress people, for anyone in power to do anything about this. We have seasoned human rights workers and activists, the whole range of ages and classes and social positions, and we are all together in solidarity to demand that this stop as soon as possible. It's already too late in Gaza, but anything to get this to stop now. This is as you say, it's a new approach, legal approach, but it's a really sound legal approach. And we're very confident in its applicability to other elected officials. It's not necessarily just isolated to Congress people. Anyone who had voted for perhaps, for example, the $26.38 billion military aid package, any official representative or senator who voted for that package can potentially be sued under the same framework that this case is bringing. And there's a lot of potential for it to expand in California still. We have filed and our defendants have been served on Christmas Eve, but there's still time to add other plaintiffs, so other representatives and other class members. There's still time to even add other elected representatives to the same suit. So we can expand here in California, but we could also be expanding across the United States. And we've been getting hundreds of calls, over 300 emails from folks since we announced on December 19th that want to take this up in their state or city across the country. And that's a huge movement with a lot of potential to actually be able to generate people power and hold our elected officials accountable to following the law.
Well, it's admirable and it sounds like a lot of work. Very, very amazing, innovative approach. And it sounds like you guys really, really, you're going to take this as far as you can. Are you guys, how are you guys going to pay for the legal bills? Who's representing you guys?
We're being represented by an amazing activist and an amazing attorney, Dean Royer, who has been doing great work over many years. His firm, it's a medium to small-sized firm, Suzetu, S-Z-E-T-O, Suzetu Wong Law. And Dean is a senior civil rights litigation attorney there. We're all grassroots people, right? So there's no, like, that we've all come together under this broad umbrella called TAG, Taxpayers Against Genocide, and we're just all pitching in, you know, like, last Friday in Santa Rosa, there was some music and poetry, and it was like a pitch-in fundraiser. The firm has given us an amazing deal. It's not pro bono, but it's certainly way below market rate, and we appreciate that. So we're trying to collect as we move. And as Maria mentioned, thanks to some of the coverage, including Flashpoint, the interest is all across the country. And so on January 25th, that's a Saturday, at 10 a.m. our time here in California, we're going to have a webinar for folks both California-based as well as across the country who are interested in seeing this lawsuit effort expand. And we're in process of developing that expansion. Again, as Maria mentioned, senators are just as culpable since they also are part of the tax appropriation process. It goes to the House and the Senate. And we're in communication with people throughout California and throughout the country who also want to sue their House reps. So that webinar, if listeners want to come to it and learn more about this, that webinar, again, will be 10 a.m. January 25th, and they can email us at classactionagainstgenocide@proton.me. classactionagainstgenocide@proton.me, and we can get you signed up for the webinar.
Well, Maria Barakat, I like how this is a combination of a legal approach and suing these guys, holding them accountable, but also building it from the grassroots. I love what's said about community events that you guys are holding as well. That's terrific.
Yeah, we've been active in the North Bay all year for 16 months. And while we are heartbroken and exhausted, sometimes hopeless, we have really built an incredible community here, and it's expanding. As you can see, we have now a tight network across 10 different counties up here in the North Bay, and we've been hosting events. Of course, we've done rallies and protests, but we've also hosted teach-ins all year for a variety of different issues, including Haiti action and Gaza, mainly focusing on Gaza this year. And we have a lot of incredible folks in our community with direct experience and can speak to what's going on, who have family on the ground. And we've built a powerful group up here.
Again, that's Maria Barakat. She's a Lebanese-Palestinian anti-war activist, sociologist of law and society, and public policy expert specializing in equity from UC Berkeley. She is part of this class action lawsuit. And also Seth Donnelly, a high school teacher, Bay Area activist, and a member of the Haiti Action Committee. I know that. Listen, you guys, I can't tell you how much I really appreciate you coming and sharing this with our listeners today. I encourage people to email you if they have any questions. Give them the email again.
Sure. classactionagainstgenocide @proton.me.
Perfect. classactionagainstgenocide@proton.me. Again, thank you guys so much for joining us today here on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin.
And let's go ahead and take a short break here. When we get back, we'll have the Electronic Intifada with Neurobios Friedman. Stay tuned.
Sometimes I wonder if it's all been in vain. It seems nothing matters. Everybody chasing fame with no message for the young to hold on to. You take what you can. God help the man who will try to stop you. Is it real what they feel?
Flashpoints presents its regular feature, the Electronic Intifada Newscast. This is the Palestinian news for the week of January 9th, 2025.
This is the Electronic Intifada Newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 461 as we enter the 16th month of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Gaza. Israel has continued its systematic campaign of destruction of Gaza, especially in the north, through the start of the new year. The head of the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees Legal Office, Philippa Greer, posted this video on December 31st and stated, quote, "Gaza's carcass. More homes convert to graves as the year draws to a close. Vast areas are stripped down to a bare shell. As conditions for life decompose, the lifesavers, the truth tellers, and the aid providers are killed and detained from blackened hospitals, scorched vans, and shelled humanitarian facilities. There is no space for the living, and the graveyards are full. 2024 fades, trust in our shared sense of humanity along with it." The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza officially recorded the killing of 395 Palestinians and 936 injuries between December 30th and January 8th alone. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, reported that during the first 7 days of the new year, at least 74 children were killed in Israeli attacks. UNICEF's executive director, Catherine Russell, said that, quote, "For the children of Gaza, the new year has brought more death and suffering from attacks, deprivation, and increasing exposure to the cold." The agency warned that the continued lack of basic shelter, combined with winter temperatures, pose serious threats to children, with more than 1 million children living in makeshift tents, and with many families displaced over the past 15 months, children face extreme risks. Since December 26th, 8 newborn babies have died from hypothermia. In a feature we published on January 4th, Frozen to Death, our contributor Tagrid Ali writes that, quote, "Children, particularly infants, bear the brunt of the suffering in winter. They are ill-equipped for the cold and generate less body heat than older children or adults. With famine stalking Gaza and no protection from the elements, children are already physically weakened, leaving them less able to fight off hypothermia." Tagrid profiled grieving parents and Dr. Ahmed Al-Fara, the head of pediatrics at Nasser Hospital. Al-Fara told the Electronic Intifada that his department has been receiving more than 5 cases per day of children suffering from hypothermia. Tagrid writes that Sila Al-Fasih succumbed to the cold on Christmas Day. She was just 2 weeks old. Her family, originally from Gaza City, lives in a dilapidated tent with no nylon over it to give protection from the rain on the shores of Al-Mawasi Beach in Khan Yunus in the southern Gaza Strip. At night, Sila's mother, Nariman Al-Fasih, 35 years old, said that the family only has 3 blankets to protect the 5 of them. In addition to Sila, there is Nihad, 2 years old, and Rayan, 4, from the freezing cold. It wasn't enough for Sila. Al-Fasih woke at 4 a.m. to breastfeed, only to find her baby daughter unresponsive, her skin a deadly pallor of blue. For more, read Tagrid Ali's feature, Frozen to Death, on electronicintifada.net. On our last live stream, we reported on Israel's abduction and subsequent disappearing of Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya, the director of the Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia in the north of Gaza. The hospital was surrounded and destroyed by Israeli forces on December 27th, after more than 80 days of relentless attacks because doctors refused to abandon their patients and staff. Abu Safiya has still not been heard from, although the Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor said it had received information that, quote, his health has deteriorated due to the torture he endured during his detention, particularly while being held at the Sde Tayman military base in southern Israel. Euromed Human Rights Monitor warns of the grave risk to his life following patterns of deliberate killings and deaths under torture previously suffered by other doctors and medical staff arrested from Gaza since October 2023. The human rights group added that it had collected testimonies, quote, confirming that Israeli soldiers physically assaulted Dr. Abu Safiya immediately after he left the hospital on Friday, December 27th. He was then directly targeted with sound bombs while attempting to evacuate the hospital in compliance with orders from the Israeli army, Euromed added. The Israelis, quote, subsequently transferred Dr. Abu Safiya to a field interrogation site in the Al-Fakhura area of Jabalia refugee camp. There, he was forced to strip off his clothes and was subjected to severe beatings, including being whipped with a thick wire commonly used for street electrical wiring. Soldiers deliberately humiliated him in front of other detainees, including fellow medical staff. He was later taken to an undisclosed location before being transferred to the Sde Tayman military camp under Israeli army control. Recently released detainees from Sde Tayman told Euromed Human Rights Monitor that Dr. Abu Safiya, quote, was subjected to severe torture, leading to a significant deterioration in his health. This occurred despite him already being injured by Israeli airstrikes on the hospital, where he worked tirelessly until the facility was stormed and set ablaze by Israeli forces. The Israeli army has attempted to mislead the public regarding Dr. Abu Safiya's detention and torture, Euromed stated. Pro-Israeli media outlets circulated a misleading promotional video portraying his treatment as humane, even though he was tortured and humiliated immediately after filming. On January 2nd, Physicians for Human Rights Israel had submitted a request on behalf of Abu Safiya's family to obtain information about his condition and facilitate a lawyer's visit. But the Israelis claimed to have no record of his detention. Euromed Monitor warned that Abu Safiya could face a similar fate as Dr. Adnan Al-Bursh, head of the orthopedics department at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Dr. Al-Bursh was killed by torture at Ofer Prison last April. Another doctor, Abu Safiya's colleague Iyad Al-Rantisi, who was the head of the obstetrics department at Kamal Adwan Hospital, was also killed by torture at an Israeli Shin Bet facility 1 week after he was detained in November 2023. Euromed added that Israel concealed his death for more than 7 months. On Tuesday, Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya's mother died of a heart attack. As we reported, her grandson, Hussam Abu Safiya's son, Ibrahim, was killed by an Israeli drone strike in October. Hussam Abu Safiya led the funeral prayers for Ibrahim before burying him in the hospital's courtyard, and at the time, he accused the Israeli army of killing his son as a punishment for refusing to abandon the hospital and his staff and patients. With the total decimation of Kamal Adwan Hospital, as well as the Indonesian hospital, and the prevention by the Israelis of any medical workers to enter the north of Gaza, there is only one hospital left, which is barely operating. The aid group Relief International reports that Al-Auda Hospital in Jabalia is the last medical facility in the north, and it is hanging on by a thread. On January 3rd, Al-Auda received orders to forcibly remove all hospital staff and patients, quote, or else the facility would be bombed, including all of those inside, Relief International stated. The group added that the hospital has been targeted, destroying the fuel tank and last running generator as shelling in the surrounding area continues. 63 staff and 34 patients remain inside. The facility has no electricity, but continues to receive patients, providing the best possible treatment with no fuel and a severe shortage of medication and medical supplies. The United Nations warned on Wednesday that, quote, zero fuel reserves to operate electricity generators at hospitals across Gaza are placing the lives of patients, including newborns, at grave risk. On Wednesday, the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis announced that all generators at the facility have stopped, and only a small generator is currently operating with an amount sufficient for 3 hours. In a press conference also on Wednesday, the Ministry of Health in Gaza stated that there is no fuel stock in hospitals due to the restrictions imposed on fuel entry and looting, warning that if no additional fuel is received, this will cause a catastrophe affecting the functioning of oxygen generators, medicine refrigerators, and incubators. The health ministry added that a patient died on Wednesday due to the lack of fuel needed to operate kidney dialysis machines. Hours later, the ministry reported that a small amount of fuel to operate hospital generators was received, which would allow for only 24 hours of continuation of services. Our contributor Abu Bakr Abed reported on the kidney disease crisis across Gaza. In a feature we published yesterday, Kidney Patients Face Excruciating Death in Gaza, Abu Bakr profiled several patients as well as Abdul Nasser Abu Aisha, the head nurse of the dialysis department at Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir el-Balah. When the war broke out, we had 106 kidney patients here at the hospital, Abu Aisha said. When the Israeli military launched its ground operations in Rafah in early May, we ended up with nearly 5 times this number. The numbers of kidney patients have come down now, Abu Aisha said, because half the patients have died in the meantime of various causes, mostly related to hospital overcrowding and the general conditions in Gaza. In order to manage kidney disease, Abu Bakr reports, people are usually told to avoid dirty water and eat a balanced diet, but most humanitarian food assistance comes in the form of canned foods that are not healthy for kidney patients. The preservatives in canned food turn into toxins, taking a heavy toll on their health, Abu Aisha said. And with health services debilitated and medicines scarce, medical professionals are struggling to cope. The war must stop now, Abu Aisha said. There is no other solution. Abu Bakr spoke to a 14-year-old boy, Imad, who nearly died when he fell into a coma during one visit to the hospital. Quote, the boy also has anemia and inflammation and struggles to stand on his feet, his father said. And then there is the pain. My legs always hurt me, Imad told the Electronic Intifada. I can't sleep or do anything. I also haven't eaten bread for 2 days. I don't want to see these tubes on my body anymore. I just want to be like other children, and I want to go home with my family. For more, read Abu Bakr Abed's feature, Kidney Patients Face Excruciating Death in Gaza, on electronicintifada.net. Israel is continuing not just to prevent humanitarian aid, fuel, medicines, and food as the ethnic slaughter entrenches in North Gaza, but it is also continuing to destroy the aid and kill those delivering it. Israeli forces are also bolstering and supporting the actions of armed gangs in looting and deliberately undermining social order. According to the aid group Oxfam this week, quote, of the meager 34 trucks of food and water given permission to enter the North Gaza governorate over the last 2.5 months, deliberate delays and systematic obstructions by the Israeli military meant that just 12 trucks managed to distribute aid to starving Palestinian civilians. For 3 of these, once the food and water had been delivered to the school where people were sheltering, the school was then cleared and shelled within hours. Sally Abi Khalil, Oxfam's Middle East and North Africa director, stated, quote, the situation in Gaza is apocalyptic and people are trapped, unable to find any kind of safety. The absolute desperation of having no food or shelter for your family in the biting cold of winter. It is abhorrent that despite international law being so publicly violated by Israel and starvation being used relentlessly as a weapon of war, world leaders continue to do nothing. The United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, Tom Fletcher, stated on January 6th that the UN's efforts to save lives are at a breaking point. Fletcher said that, quote, An Israeli strike seriously injured three people at a known food distribution point where a partner of the World Food Program was operating. Israeli soldiers fired over 16 bullets at a clearly marked UN convoy at the checkpoint from the south to the north. Armed Palestinian gangs hijacked six fuel tankers entering from the Kerem Shalom crossing, leaving us hardly any fuel for aid operations. These incidents are part of a dangerous pattern of sabotage and deliberate disruption. Fletcher added that on January 3rd, Israeli forces increased attacks during the movement of a 74-truck aid convoy. A drone strike hit a vehicle from the local community, which was protecting part of the convoy. And just a few days ago, a UN mission out of Jabalia ran into hostile Israeli soldiers who threatened critical patients and arrested four of them. There is no meaningful civil order, Fletcher stated. Israeli forces are unable or unwilling to ensure the safety of our convoys. Statements by Israeli authorities vilify our aid workers even as the military attacks them. Community volunteers who accompany our convoys are being targeted. There is now a perception that it is dangerous to protect aid convoys, but safe to loot them. Euromed Human Rights Monitor reported this week that Israel's support of organized gangs in Gaza in order to steal humanitarian aid is a deliberate attempt to, quote, spread chaos and insecurity as part of its genocidal war and create disastrous conditions that will result in the destruction of Palestinians in the Strip as a whole. Israel's army has attempted to target members of the security and civil police forces, as well as individuals working to coordinate the entry of humanitarian aid. Since the start of its genocide on October 7, 2023, Israel has been targeting members of these groups or teams while they are working and even while they are in their homes or shelters, Euromed added. The Gaza government media office stated on January 2nd that the Israeli army assassinated Major General Mahmoud Salah, the director general of the Palestinian police in the Gaza Strip, and his assistant, Major General Hussam Shawan, quote, in a cowardly assassination operation that targeted them while they were performing their national and humanitarian duty in the Al-Mawasi area in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, which the occupation claims is a safe humanitarian area, resulting in more martyrs and wounded. The media office warned that, quote, this escalation comes with a clear plan by which the Israeli occupation aims to create an administrative and governmental vacuum and spread chaos and security chaos in the Gaza Strip in an attempt to undermine the steadfastness of our people and destabilize them. The horrific rise in the number of martyrs of aid workers to 736 shows the extent of the crimes committed by the occupation, which targets everyone who tries to provide aid and relief to our afflicted Palestinian people. Israel killed two journalists in Gaza this past week. On January 2nd, Israel killed Hassan al-Kashawi in a drone strike. And on January 3rd, Omar Salah al-Dirawi, who is a photojournalist and worked with a number of news agencies, was killed in an Israeli bombing of his house in the Azueda area in the central Gaza Strip, according to the Gaza government media office. This brings the number of journalists and media workers killed by Israel since October 2023 to 202. Finally, as we always do, we wanted to share images of people expressing defiance and resilience in the face of Israel's campaign of destruction. Twitter ex-user Noor Gaza posted these photos of birds on top of her tent after a rainstorm. She says, quote, I didn't want to let all the rainwater fall off the top of the tent so the birds could drink from it. Ali Juma of North Gaza posted this video of himself, his friend, and children playing during a hailstorm. And journalist Anas Al-Sharif, who is one of the remaining reporters in North Gaza and has been separated from his family because of his work, was reunited with his baby son Salah this week.
يلا واحد اثنين
And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza, and also to read Tamara Nassar's important coverage of the situation in the occupied West Bank, which I did not have time to get to. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
Let's take another short break here, and when we get back, we're going to talk about the banning of TikTok or its forced sale to a U.S. company, but particularly, is this being done because of the role that it's played in showing the world what's actually been going on in Gaza? We'll talk to an activist about that and more here on Flashpoints. Be sure to stay tuned.
Talking about the white sunshine, I know this ain't mine. Knocking down that door, gotta grind his 9 to 5. Got to stack the paper up right now. Take care of being mine. We got to work, baby.
And this is Flashpoints. Tomorrow, the U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear oral arguments against TikTok, basically. The Congress wants to force it into U.S. ownership. President-elect Trump apparently supports that, although we hear he's kind of on the fence about it. And the Supreme Court is going to render a decision about that 10 days later on January the 19th. Here's a quick soundbite from Fox News in Minneapolis.
Tomorrow, big day, the Supreme Court will be taking on the possible TikTok ban.
The justices will decide if the ultimatum given to the app's parent company is a free speech violation, all looming here before the deadline when TikTok will supposedly go away. Arce Kwan talked to a legal expert about this case and fills us in on what we need to know and maybe what we can watch for tomorrow. Good morning, Say.
Hey, good morning to you guys. Well, yeah, for many of us, we use TikTok to watch funny videos, maybe get caught up on some of the current trends. But for the content creators behind those videos, TikTok is more than just an app to them. It's actually how they pay their bills. Now, this debate all started over concerns that the China-based app poses a national security threat. Lawmakers worry its parent company, ByteDance, has access to American data and is sharing that with the Chinese government. Now, if lawmakers have their way here, TikTok will be banned in the U.S. in less than 2 weeks. That is unless ByteDance sells the app to an approved buyer by January 19th. So now TikTok is asking the nation's highest court to overturn the U.S. appeals court ruling, which justifies the free speech violation because of those national security concerns.
I think one of the reasons, again, that the court was willing to uphold the law is because this isn't just national security versus the First Amendment. This is different parts of the First Amendment sort of at war with themselves. And TikTok doesn't have a monopoly on upholding the First Amendment here.
And now I'd like to welcome Rand Jitan of the Adala Justice Project. Welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing today?
Good day. But as you can hear, the battle is brewing to either force the sale of TikTok or ban it altogether. Those of you who are familiar with the platform know that it has been one of the main ways that many people have understood and known about Israeli ongoing genocide in Gaza. I wanted to focus on that aspect of it with you today. Do you think that the exposure on TikTok of what's going on in Gaza has led to this push to either ban TikTok or to sell it to a U.S. company?
Yeah, absolutely, Kevin. I think for starters, as somebody who's been on TikTok for a while now, I remember back in 2021 was one of the first times that I saw folks really start to open their eyes to what's happening in Palestine. There was a popular uprising that happened around that time. So that was really an opportunity for folks to learn what was happening on the ground as videos were going viral outside of Palestine. And of course, we're seeing that extend through today with the genocide that we are funding, Israel's genocide that we're funding in Gaza itself. And, you know, we're just seeing the most horrific scenes coming out from on the ground. And really what's happening is this is a live stream genocide, right? This isn't AI. This isn't people editing videos to make it look a certain way. We are watching live on the ground what is happening. So it's undeniable that there are grave injustices happening that we're paying for with our tax dollars. And people are upset. And all they're doing is calling it out and making the connections to how over here in the States, folks are suffering. You know, folks are suffering. We're watching the wildfires now in LA. We had Appalachia just this past October where folks are still living in tents as a result of the neglect from FEMA. During the same week that the hurricanes hit the ground, Joe Biden gave out $9 billion to Israel. And now we're seeing here, just days before the fires, he just gave $8 billion, another $8 billion to Israel to continue to bomb Gaza. And we know there's evidence that that has climate effects on the rest of the planet. So really with TikTok, what I've noticed is you're just seeing people of all ages. We know that, you know, I'm a millennial, and we associate the app with younger folks. And of course, younger folks, you know, it's the first time they're learning, so they tend to have this certain passion around this advocacy, wanting to be involved. But we're seeing it with all ages, people opening their eyes and making those connections of how our government is failing us while actively continuing a genocide. And so when I hear about the potential ban of TikTok, I think it's hard to not assume that our government doesn't want people to make these connections. They don't want people to wake up and realize, hey, wait, hold on. Why am I struggling to pay rent? Why are my tax dollars simultaneously going to bomb kids overseas when I can't even afford rent and I'm struggling to put food on the table to feed my own family? And people are feeling abandoned by that. And I think that this sort of, we know there's also evidence of disinformation in mainstream media. So people are taking media into their own hands. You know, we've got young journalists on the ground in Gaza. We've got young journalists on the ground here in the States. We're seeing Greta Thunberg. She's also, you know, for a while now been taking on that responsibility. So really the information is accessible and people are making their own conclusions, and they're fact-based, they're evidence-based. And I think it's to the disadvantage of our government that people realize that and they start to ask more questions and they start to demand that their funding instead be invested in their communities and to divest from the war machine, the weapons manufacturers that are essentially, you know, controlling our government in many ways. So I can see how that would be an obvious reason for them to want to remove TikTok. And I think, honestly, the only reason that they would keep it is for money interest. I used to work in advertising. I know how much money goes into social media advertising. And that's really, I think, the only reason that they wouldn't remove it is if there's interest to just keep making money.
And you're listening to Flashpoints. And that's the voice of my guest, Rind Jitan. She's with the Abdallah Justice Project. We're talking about the potential banning of TikTok or its for sale to U.S. entity, which we can imagine would turn it into a very different platform than it is today. But there's a sort of openness to it, isn't there, Rind, where we could see, as you said, this is the first live streamed Holocaust genocide being committed by Israel in Gaza. And the images were just overwhelming. I mean, the flattening of buildings with people in them, people being dug out of the rubble, the murdering of children, the just unvarnished hubris, if you will, of Israelis themselves who were lauding and applauding the death was seen and aired almost live as it occurred on TikTok.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's devastating. Even as somebody who's Palestinian, like, I remember from a very early age being aware of what's happening. And, you know, it's not like we get used to this, you know. Our people are not used to this kind of violence. We're not accustomed to this. So even for us, it's shocking and it's devastating and it's heartbreaking. I mean, how many more images of our own babies can we see under rubble? How many more images can we see of adults and families and elderly being forcibly and violently removed from their homes into the streets, into tents? It's beyond devastating. And we know that the situation is also, we know there's also multiple genocides. We have a genocide in Sudan. We have a genocide in Congo. So this awareness, this waking up, it's also making us all realize that we have an immense responsibility with the privilege that we have here in the United States, as a country that is so heavily responsible, directly responsible for these crimes. We have the privilege and the responsibility to do something at the bare minimum. I mean, even back in last year, the polls showed that a majority of Democrats and a majority even Americans, Republicans and Democrats, regardless of a political affiliation, wanted a ceasefire, demanded a ceasefire, want an end to this, you know. And I think that is, even an arms embargo, not even just a ceasefire, but an arms embargo, just a complete halt of weapons to Israel so that that money can go back to our communities while people here are suffering, vulnerable communities. I was just in Appalachia in October, and you know, we witnessed it firsthand, the devastation, the government abandoning its own people, and really the beauty of it is people helping each other, the mutual aid networks. The people were passionately making these connections, and it's unfortunately it's not enough because it's underserved people helping other underserved people. And I've been in the streets, I've been around the world, and I'm seeing that it is Palestine in general. This is the most diverse movement I've ever been a part of. I'm seeing all kinds of people in the streets, and that goes to show that we all are so incredibly aware of how we're connected, how the forces working against us are connected, which means that we also have to be united. And I'm seeing that the news doesn't accurately reflect the diversity of this movement. It doesn't accurately reflect how many different kinds of people are helping each other to get through this, the mutual aid and the community care and the political resistance to these systems that are harming us. That's where the focus should be, is how we can unite and demand better for our world, our planet as a whole.
Well, those are great thoughts, great ideas. Again, that's my guest, Ren Jitan. She's with the Adala Justice Project in Carbon, Illinois. Really beautiful sentiment. I share it, of course, but I'm a little bit circumspect about the political direction of our country. And, you know, I've seen the power of AIPAC, you know, and, yep, and great people's lives destroyed simply for speaking the truth.
Right.
It's a long battle ahead, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And, you know, something I like to remind folks is that, unfortunately, there are risks to be taken, even just by, we watched people lose their jobs over just calling for a ceasefire, just demanding, hey, can we not bomb babies? Would that be all right if we just didn't do that, you know? And it's really absurd to be met with violence. I've also visited college campuses and witnessed firsthand the violence that students were at the effect of for just demanding to cut ties with weapons manufacturers, you know? Just saying, hey, can my money that I'm going to debt for to get a degree, to get an education so that I can have a viable future, can that money not be used to kill children? And people were met with police violence.
Right.
I witnessed many people getting hospitalized, going to jail, young people, you know, and to see that bravery is really empowering to be around that. But I think the important takeaway from all that is I always like to remind people, you're not risking all of this, you're not losing opportunities or whatever it is that you're risking or losing in this process because of Palestine. It's because of Zionism. It's because of, like you mentioned, AIPAC. It's because we know that there is evidence, there is money being put into politicians' pockets to make decisions about what does and doesn't happen for Palestinians, right? So it's not the Palestinians' fault that all of this is happening. It's the fault of the people who, you know, want the genocide to continue so they can continue to line their pockets and have regional power or whatever interests they have. Meanwhile, the people unanimously, globally, even here in the United States, have made it very clear we don't want this reality for us or for people we've never even met overseas.
Well, thank you, Ren Jitan, the Adala Justice Project in Glen Carbon, Illinois. Thank you so much for joining us here today on Flashpoints.
Yep, thank you, Kevin. Appreciate you.
And that wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements.